Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And we've got two guests up for today's show. First, in a few minutes, we'll speak with Susan Marks, who is the author of a new book called Aquashock, The Water Crisis in America, just out from Bloomberg Books. We'll talk about the shortage of water. This is a planet full of water, but not all of the kind that we need, when we need it, and where we need it, and what the dimensions of the problem are, and what we can do about that. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Walter Ben Michaels, who is a professor at the University of Illinois Chicago, who is author of a rather controversial series of books and essays on diversity versus equality. He's provocatively one of these pieces in the New Left Review called Against Diversity, and the more recent one in the the London Review of Books on What Matters is the title, but a review of the race and class conflict and gender and all that. And before all that, some words on the news. Breaking news from the Change We Can Believe In front. The Obama administration is opposing congressional legislation to protect reporters from being jailed for refusing to reveal who disclosed confidential information to them for national security reasons, of course. As Charlie Savage put it in a report in the New York Times the other day, the bill includes safeguards that would require prosecutors to exhaust other methods for finding the source of the information before subpoenaing a reporter, and would balance investigators' interests with the public interest in gathering news and maintaining the free flow of information. Obama doesn't like this, and he'd like judges to be told to be deferential to the executive branch when it screams national security in such cases. And the inaptly named Jason Ditz reported on antiwar.com a couple of weeks ago, the administration is seeking the extension of several major provisions of the Patriot Act, including one that would allow the government to subpoena library and bookstore records, and other provisions that make it easier to wiretap on the executive branch's whim. Oh, and given congressional Democrats' opposition to sending more troops to Afghanistan in the pursuit of God knows what, the administration is going to turn to the Republicans for backing if it needs it. On issues of imperial war and the national security state, Obama 1 is looking more and more like Bush 3. Speaking of Obama, his little junket to Copenhagen to plead Chicago's case before the International Olympic Committee is rather strange. My first thought in hearing this was that this is an odd mission for a president to undertake, especially one with a collapsed economy to revive, a disastrous health plan to promote, and a failed war to escalate. My second thought was, on listening to Obama flack Keith Olbermann tout the economic development aspects of hosting the Olympics, my second reaction was to be deeply suspicious. As I recall the history of the Olympics, a topic I covered when I was first doing this show, back in the time of the 1996 Atlanta Games, they're typically a pretext for urban renewal, which is a polite way of saying displacing poor people in the interest of gentrification. So I thought it was time to do a little research. Thankfully, the Chicago Reader, especially in the person of their contributor, Ben Jarofsky, has done a lot of work on this issue, all of it conveniently available on their website. In a nutshell, the Chicago bid is an obsession of Mayor Richard Daley and the city's real estate and business elite. Polls show that city residents are about equally divided on whether the Olympics will be good for the city or not. The roster of contributors to Chicago 2016, the group of local worthies leading the campaign, is a who's who of Chicagoland's corporate elite. Winning the games would greatly satisfy their lust for prestige and money, of course. But the major recipients of the money would probably be the real estate interests, who'd see buildings erected with public subsidy and neighborhoods cleared of troublesome poor people. What about the other economic benefits? There are probably some, mostly short-term ones, jobs for construction workers, parking lot attendants, and hot dog vendors. But the evidence is that there's little or no long-term payoff from hosting the Olympic Games. Even the accommodations industry might not gain all that much. The Reader's Deanna Isaacs reports that European studies show that while there's a boost to tourism from the Games themselves, the number of visitors before and after the Games often declines, resulting in a wash. So what's in it for Obama? Well, a lot of his friends are in the game. His advisor and close friend Valerie Jarrett was on the board of Chicago 2016, and two current members of the board were money people in his campaign. Many of the business cheerleaders for the effort were crucial early supporters. In other words, the trip is payback. So this is why the chief executive of the world bourgeoisie, as the folks at Workers' Vanguard call the occupant of the Oval Office, is comporting himself like a big city mayor. And now a special breaking news update prepared especially for the KPFA and podcast audiences. Friday morning brought the release of the September U.S. employment report, and it was pretty bad. About the only good thing you can say about it is that it wasn't as bad as the ones we were getting early in the year. And that's about the extent of the good things you can say about it. As I always point out when reviewing these things, the monthly employment numbers are based on two surveys, one of about 300,000 employers and the other of about 60,000 households. The first, known as the Establishment or Payroll Survey, is the most reliable source of information on employment levels, along with wages and the length of the work week. The second is the source of the familiar unemployment numbers. The Payroll Survey reported the loss of 263,000 jobs in September. That's a half or a third as much as we saw in the early part of the year, but it's still an awful number. There was an unusually large loss of 53,000 government jobs, mainly at the local level. Some of this may be technical factors, like back-to-school oddities, but it's also likely that fiscal troubles are really beginning to bite. The private sector lost 210,000 jobs, with hardly any major sectors showing even tiny gains. Hardest hit were construction and manufacturing, but retail was also down hard. Even the indefatigable healthcare sector added far less than usual. September was the 21st consecutive month of job loss, the longest streak since monthly figures began in 1939. Since the recession started in December 2007, we've lost more than 7 million jobs. In percentage terms, this is easily the harshest recession since the post-World War II demobilization. Thanks to the recession's severity and the weakness of the 2002-07 expansion, private employment is now well below where it was at its December 2000 peak. We have never seen anything remotely like that kind of long-term carnage in 70 years of monthly stats. And that's not all. The monthly surveys do a heroic job of trying to capture a complex and rapidly changing job market. I have no patience for anyone who says that government statisticians are hacks or liars. But they do have a hard time dealing with turning points. They have to make a lot of assumptions about business creation and destruction, and most of the time these assumptions are well-grounded. But when a recession is beginning or a recovery is taking off, reality gets ahead of their assumptions. That's why the numbers are benchmarked every year by comparing the monthly estimates with the rigorous near 100% coverage of the employment universe provided by the unemployment insurance system. Most of the time, these so-called benchmark revisions are small, just a few tenths of a percentage point. But not this time. Every October, the Bureau of Labor Statistics announces the likely size of the revision to be applied to the data for the previous March. This is only an estimate. The official detailed revisions will come in February. The numbers for this year are very big, down 824,000. That is, 824,000 fewer people were employed in March than we originally thought. Since over 2 million jobs were lost in the first part of the year by previous reckoning, that makes the bloodletting early in this recession even more savage. Wage growth was very weak, and the work week also fell to a record low. The job market is very sick. And the household survey was, if anything, worse than its establishment counterpart. The unemployment rate rose again to 9.8%. It's likely to break 10% in a month or two. And the share of the adult population working, the so-called employment population ratio, fell hard to its lowest level since 1983. This is a stunning reversal of history. The capitalist norm has been to bring more and more people into paid work. Today's U.S. economy has thrown that into reverse. But this is entirely consistent with how economies behave after severe financial crises. Several times I've mentioned the IMF studies of financial crises around the world. While the IMF has a lot to answer for, given its long history of torturing the world's poor, their staff economists often do good research work, especially when they're studying the rich countries. The latest instance of this is the October edition of their biannual World Economic Outlook, which extends the examination of post-crisis slumps that they did in the April edition. The broad story is the same. The recessions that follow banking crises are savage and persistent. A couple of things stand out in this latest iteration of their research. One, the income losses after a financial crisis are in the order of 10%. These are permanent and not recovered in a subsequent recovery. That is, the standard textbook pattern of a V-shaped recession, a sharp fall followed by a strong bounce back, doesn't operate after such crises. And two, the job losses are also of a deep and semi-permanent sort. That is, the total number of jobs in the U.S. economy is likely to stay several million below what we otherwise would have seen had there been no crisis. It's going to stay there for many years to come. Again, no V-shaped recovery, more of an L or the mirror image of a J. In other words, this recovery is going to resemble what happens in an intensive care unit more than what happens in the Econ 101 textbooks. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk water. That a bit of the Standells classic Dirty Water, Boston, You're My Home. And in fact, I think they're not really from Boston, which is one of the ironies of that song. But anyway, Dirty Water, a good way of introducing this next segment. I'm joined by Susan Marks, who is the author of a book called Aqua Shock, The Water Crisis in America, just out from Bloomberg Books. She spent many years as a reporter and editor at the Denver Post and writing for many other outlets as well, and now is the author of this book. Welcome to Behind the News, Susan Marks.
Thank you. How are you doing tonight, Doug?
I'm just fine.
Good.
So that song is all about dirty water up in Boston, and we'll return to Boston a little bit. But water. You think it's ubiquitous. This is the water planet. What enormous quantity of the Earth consists of water?
70%, actually.
70%. I knew you'd know that number. and yet, it's getting increasingly difficult to come by. At least the kind that we can drink and use otherwise for human pursuits. Just give us some idea of the dimensions of the problem.
Well, as you mentioned, and I said 70% of the Earth is water, but less than 1% of that is the water that we can, the fresh water that we all need to drink. Actually, all living things on this planet need water too. Demands are not static. As demands increase with a static amount of water, obviously we have a competition for what's left and conflict over the competition, and we end up in the state we are today with our water. I kind of believe that water is the new oil. Our demand is increasing as populations mushroom. Prices are rising, too, yet unlike oil, there is no alternative. We all need water to live. The reasons we are running out of this fresh water are many, and they, of course, depend on who you talk to, where they are, what they're doing, what their particular occupation is or whatever. Actually, water is the most divisive and controversial issue I've ever covered in my many years as a journalist. But then I digress. The primary reasons we're running out of water, everything from the mushrooming populations to people moving where the water is not. Think Albuquerque, Phoenix, Denver, Dallas. We're talking arid climates with booming populations. We've also overused our water, overbuilt, and built paved over Earth's natural ability to replenish its water supplies. Our infrastructure, including our water treatment plants, as well as our more than 700,000 miles of pipes that crisscross underneath our cities and towns. They're worn out or they're not built to handle 21st century pollutants. Then we have laws and lack thereof and enforcement of those laws that contribute to it. So we're in a real bind with our water supplies in the United States right now.
I think maybe some of us in the Northeast are spoiled by the fact that we live in a pretty wet area, and we don't really feel these issues very acutely just yet. Are we living in a fool's paradise up here?
You said that. I didn't. This summer I was in up on Lake Erie, one of the Great Lakes, which is the largest freshwater lake system in the world, with about 20% of the Earth's water supplies. Yet, I drove down from Lake Erie to Chicago. So much water, yet the quality of that water. I live in Colorado, where quantity is an issue. We don't have enough. But in the Midwest, they have, up on the Great Lakes, they have plenty of quantity, but there's quality. The pollution includes everything. It's not just man-made pollution, it's natural pollutants. There's natural pollutants like arsenic, like radium, like radon, selenium. I mean, the list goes on for natural pollutants, and then you contribute have man's contribution to it, and we end up in a pretty tough state. That's not to say things haven't gotten better. I mean, 1969, the Cayuga River in Cleveland caught on fire. Lake Erie was declared dead. Now, in both instances today, we know that Lake Erie is a vibrant lake and that the Cayuga River has been cleaned up and everything. We're much better off than we were, but we still have so far to go.
Well, you mentioned Colorado, and the river, the Colorado River, is, of course, a lust object of many parts of the West. They want that water, right? I mean, that's tapped by many people, and it's a subject of a great fight, isn't it?
Well, water per se is a subject of a great fight in the West. The Colorado River, interestingly enough, I had one person tell me when I wrote Aquashock that one of the problems, reasons why the Colorado River is always out of water per se, the allocations have already are never really met, is because when they originally signed the treaty that divided the water in the Colorado River among the states that needed it and Mexico, it was a high water year. So, I mean, the numbers, of course, have nothing to do with anything. But, for example, if you and I and two other people signed a treaty that says that, okay, you get 20 gallons, that's 40, and then I get 30 gallons, and you get 30 gallons, so that's 100 gallons. But on an average year, the river only has 80 gallons, and somebody's always going to be out of water. So, you know, there's where we start, and then you have so many people moving to these places out, these arid climates out in the desert or whatever.
Yeah, I've long thought that not many people should really live in Phoenix, yet it's a booming city. I mean, where does Phoenix get its water? How does it cope?
Some of it comes from the rivers. Some of it comes from underground aquifers. I can move from Phoenix. Let's go to a place like, let's go to a place like El Paso, which is just as arid a climate. For years, El Paso's had problems with water. Then they were somewhat forward thinking, and they did a water plan, and they decided that they were going to run out if things kept on the way they were. So they started instituting ways to conserve water, reuse gray water usage. That's water that has already been used once. They recycle it. They use that to water their golf courses. They have an inland desalination plant, which taps the underground aquifers. So, you know, I had another hydrologist talk to me about. He was flying over one of the New Mexico cities. I don't know, it's Phoenix, something like that, Phoenix, Albuquerque, or something. And he was struck by the contradiction what he saw below. That is, a giant city in the middle of the desert with everyone with a swimming pool in their backyard, but how divisive is the water issue? Who in Phoenix is going to give up their swimming pool, or for that matter, who's willing to give up golf in the desert? You know, those are all water intensive activities, and you know, at some point we are going to face decisions that will affect our lifestyles. That we have to make changes. I mean, we can't grow water intensive crops by irrigation in the desert.
I'm speaking with Susan Marks, who is the author of Aquashock, The Water Crisis in America, just out from Bloomberg Books. And you've got a lot of kind of gee whiz stats scattered throughout the book. I'm kind of amazed by some of them. You know, the average American uses, what, about 100 gallons of water a day?
Yeah, 80 to 100 gallons. But I have to tell you, even in dispute are those numbers. I mean, they range all over the place. Different people will tell you it's different numbers. I've had water experts tell me that, well, if you live in Boston where there's a lot of rain, you know, you're going to use less water than if you live in Phoenix, per se, where you're in an arid climate. So the numbers are all over the place, but somehow you have to quantify them. And 80 to 100 gallons a day is the average. But there's a statistic related to that I think is even more mind-boggling, and that's that the average American uses 152 tons of water in a single year, and that's just for in-home household use. I just think that's amazing.
Yeah, that is amazing. But this, you know, 80 to 100 gallon a day figure is really just about showering and washing the dishes and drinking and taking, you know, that sort of routine day-to-day use. But you know, we actually consume much more than that through indirectly. Like a pound of beef requires, what, 3,000 gallons of water to produce?
Well, I'll tell you, those statistics are very – some people think that those kinds of statistics are suspect because it's just – I mean, these are all such quantifying. Just like they have people have come up with the water footprint, like a carbon footprint per se. The best way to look at it is we consume a lot of water. I mean, these numbers are, if the U.S. uses 408 billion gallons of water every single day, it takes water to produce our energy and deliver our water. It takes water to grow our food. It takes water to mine our minerals. It takes water. I mean, it just takes water for everything.
Yeah, I think the New York Times had a piece today saying that even solar energy requires lots of water.
Oh, and yeah.
The sunny parts of the country are also the driest. So.
It's not funny, but kind of an ironic thing is, we're talking about alternative energies like oil shale. Oil shale is one of the most water-intensive production that there are. And the worst part about it is the big deposits of oil shale are in places like Colorado where we're short on water.
So
it's not funny, but I mean it is kind of when you think about it.
Well, yeah, but people, I guess, really don't think about how much water they use. They think that they fill a glass of water or take a shower, but that's only scratching the surface of what the kind of water consumption.
Something to note, though, we're just talking about the United States. I mean, elsewhere in other nations of the world, they use much, much less. I mean, the Pacific Institute out of California will give you an example. Like the Netherlands uses maybe 27 gallons of water a day. In Gambia and Africa, they use like 1.2 gallons a day. So, why should we even have to worry about how much water we have? Because Earth is a closed cycle. We have the same amount of water that we had millions of years ago, and we'll have for eons more.
You're doing my work for me. I was going to ask you that question.
We have to worry about.
Yeah, so we do have a fixed quantity of water. It's not going away. But so what is the problem? It's just not in the right place or of the right kind?
All of the above. There is no silver bullet. Everybody wants. Okay, so what's the solution? There is no silver bullet. Everybody. There's all different kinds of things. I was on a panel in Chicago last week and with a policymaker, John Austin, from Michigan, and he pointed out that the water will be possibly one of the next great job generators in our society because it's ripe for entrepreneurship. There are so many things that can be done, and each person, somebody who's creative can sit down and solve a problem. I mean, there are so many problems we can't even possibly list them, and there are solutions that haven't been invented yet.
We're also losing immense quantities of water to leaky pipes, right? The infrastructure is in pretty terrible shape.
Yeah, I'm sorry that this is just radio. I have a great visual. I have the Iowa Rural Water Association loaned me a section of a water pipe that shows the inside of that water pipe, and it's only a 40-year-old pipe. It looks like it's a relic that's been buried in the sea for 200 years.
Well, we still have some wooden pipes in New York City, so.
They have wooden pipes, and I know they have. Don't they have brick and mortar pipes in some still broken brick and mortar pipes in Boston? The problem with these old pipes is that they leak, and shame on them leaking. But it's not that they leak the water out; they leach away the fresh water, and there have been studies that have been done that show that that it's billions of gallons of water every year. In the city of Atlanta alone, in one recent year, they lost enough fresh water leached away to serve the household needs of a city like Houston for an entire year. I had some statistics in Aquashock about the city of Boston. It's kind of frightening.
Its leakage is equal to the flow of the Charles River, right?
Yeah, yes, and I believe if you add in the stormwater runoff, it equals 2 Charles River in 1 year. So it's kind of.
And by paving everything, of course, we're losing a lot of that runoff. It doesn't go back into the earth and where it can be drawn again, right?
Replenish the aquifers. People don't realize, like if you look outside, all those. Parking lots and buildings, they do. They take the water that runs off, and they end up in storm drains, which carry the water far away and out of the watershed so that further wastes. And that's not just a phenomenon of the United States. That's a global phenomenon, and it's and it's in developed and less developed countries.
So we have here a whole host of massive civil engineering projects to plug the leaks and to recapture a lot of that lost water, don't we?
Yes. You know, there have been some estimates that just to replace the aging pipes in the United States is a $1 trillion proposition over the next 20 years or so. I mean, that came out from the EPA and the Congressional Budget Office. So, I mean, this is ripe for jobs and ripe for businesses. You know, I had one person ask me, is this the next great commodity that people can make lots of money on? Well, I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that that no matter how you look at it, water is going to play a role in our future, period. There's nothing that we can do about that.
And then how does climate change figure into the story?
Well, I don't, you know, some people, I was at a meeting today, and a couple of people didn't even buy into climate change. Whether you buy into climate change or not, if you can go online and Google some of these things, there's some great examples of melting glaciers. I have a picture in front of me of the Grinnell Glacier in Montana. And it's a side-by-side picture from 1900 and 2008. And there's glacier there. In 1900, there's no glacier there in 2008, and I mean something is happening, whether it's climate change or not, and one of the results of that is that again our infrastructure isn't built to handle the changes that are occurring. In other words, our reservoirs, for example, some of them are built in the wrong place and they're not big enough to handle an earlier runoff so that they hold more water, so they can hold on to it for the drier months. So I mean, it's just steamrolling. Everything is related to everything else, and it just we have to pay attention.
Well, it seems like we've had an epidemic of droughts, especially in the southern part of the country, and then Atlanta just had enormous floods. So this is extreme weirdness going on in the world of water.
So much for prognosticators and prognostications.
How much can we address the problem just by being less profligate? I mean, Americans use water the way we use energy in far greater quantities than most other people in the world.
Well, you know, sometimes you think about, you know, we do need to think about it a little bit more. If you stop, you know, the EPA has a great website called WaterSense, or it's like epa.gov/WaterSense, as in S-E-N-S-E. And, you know, they list some things. There are lots of things we can do. One simple thing is turn off the water when you brush your teeth. That'll save you maybe 8 gallons a day. I mean, that sounds like not much, but when you have, you know, 200-300 million people, that's a lot of water saved. Something else that we can do is, this we don't often think about, sometimes, you know, you want in the summer particularly, you want to go out and wash your car. Instead of washing your car yourself, take it to the car wash. And that's not necessarily because I don't necessarily promote the car wash business, but you know, they recycle water at a car wash. They have ways to capture the water to prevent pollution as well as, you know, save on water. Use your dishwasher once less a week. It goes on and on. There's a great website that I believe it's the U.S. Geological Survey has, a drip accumulator. It will amaze you how much water is saved simply by repairing a leaky faucet. Thousands of gallons of water a day.
And then running the faucet also uses a lot of energy, doesn't it?
Yes. It says running the faucet for 5 minutes a day uses as much energy as leading on a light with a 60-watt bulb for 14 hours. You know, this just brings up something else. There have been riots in India over... because the power went out, but they're not rioting over no power, they're rioting over no water, because it takes electricity to run the pumps to bring the water up from the wells. We're just a very water dependent society. Period.
We've only got a minute or so left, but it doesn't. Sometimes it strikes me that the problem with water is this is not a very glamorous problem. I mean, water seems so ordinary, and it's kind of hard to get people excited about it.
I had one water negotiator and water expert tell me that it costs more to get cell phone service than it does to get water. And considering we can do without our cell phone service, but we can't do without our our water, I find that kind of, there's this word again, I find it kind of mind-boggling.
So is water too cheap, really?
That's not for me to decide. You know, I had other people tell me that water is, that they price water what it costs to deliver. And some other people say that we price it way too low. There are not many water, municipal water people that will tell you, that will dispute the fact that they've done too good a job delivering water for too long to too many people.
That just seems so effortless. Turn on the tap and it's there. But
what's in that water when you turn on that tap?
I don't want to think about that at all. All right. Well, thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Susan Marks, who is the author of the book Aquashock, The Water Crisis in America. Very broad and a comprehensive treatment and very readable treatment of very important. But it's one of those unglamorous problems that's actually our lives depend on it. All right. This is just out from Bloomberg Books. Let's take a break, and we'll be back to talk about race and gender and things like that. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web at kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program, Behind the News. Was a bit of Beethoven's Sonata No. 24 for Therese, performed by Andras Schiff. I got an email from somebody recently who said, less Beethoven, more jazz. I couldn't disagree more. I don't think you can ever get enough Beethoven. All right, we're now joined on the line by Walter Ben Michaels, who is a professor of American literature and literary theory at the University of Illinois Chicago, author of a series of books and articles challenging the sacred status of diversity. There's a piece from New Left Review, July-August 2008, called Against Diversity, a provocative title, but actually does encapsulate a good bit of Walter Ben Michaels' position, and he's attracted some hostility for taking this position, so let's hear him speak his piece here. Welcome to Behind the News, Walter Ben Michaels.
Thanks very much, Doug. I'm glad to be here.
First of all, just a sort of biographical question. How did a professor of literature get involved in what looks to be something more of the province of the sociology department?
Well, I've always worked on American literature, and my sort of early work was sort of about American literature, actually its relation to capital and capitalism in the 19th century. But I began working about 15 years ago on texts from the 1920s and got interested in the problem of race and the question of racism and racial identity in American literature, and at the same time got interested in the history of sort of accounts of what racial identity was. And so I was struck over time by two things. One was that race remained an ongoing topic, and second of all, even as people began to become generally widely and almost universally committed to the idea that race was not a biological entity, nobody at all was willing to give up the idea that race was nonetheless a significant thing. If it was not biological, it got to be called a social construction. So I wrote a couple of things attacking the idea that race was a social construction, and then I found myself just writing about race, no longer writing about literature, at least on that topic.
What is it if it's not a social construction?
Well, I mean, race. There is no such thing as race. Race is a mistake. You know, what there is instead is there certainly is racism, and racism, as it turns out, doesn't require races. And there are lots of people who believe in races. They believe either in the sort of inherent logic of the social construction position, or they still believe more plausibly, but equally incorrectly, in some royal part of your body that's supposed to count as telling you what race you belong to. But in fact, no one, I think, really argues at this point that there is any such anything that does the work that we want the word or the concept race to do for us. So that makes it all the more striking that we are nonetheless completely committed to dividing our society up and understanding things along racial lines, particularly at a time when a plausible alternative would be to understand our society along social lines, that is to say, along class lines.
But I think God is a mistake, but people nonetheless believe in that.
Absolutely.
And it has a lot of influence in the way people live their lives and treat each other.
Indeed, so does race.
Now, you're arguing that that diversity is one of the central concepts of a kind of liberal branch of neoliberalism. This use of liberal in American usage is sometimes hard to sort out. But, you know, this is kind of the left wing of neoliberalism, if you want to call it that. They're very proud of their record of diversity. And you argue that it actually is one of the selling points of neoliberalism. How is that?
Well, I mean, there's two things about it. One is that the whole topic of diversity begins to become central in American life in the late 1970s, and that does, of course, roughly coincide with the beginning of what we sort of now call neoliberalism, and we can just mean by neoliberalism here, among other things, the increasing and increasingly radical increase in economic inequality that's taken place over the last 30 years as the rich in the U.S. and not just the U.S. have gotten richer and the poor have not. So I was struck in the first place just by the fact that as we got more and more committed to diversity and more committed to a model of social justice, which essentially understood disparities between racial or cultural groups as the crucial problem and understood itself as trying to overcome those disparities, we made some, by no means complete, but quite a good deal of progress at overcoming some of those disparities, that is, at sort of beginning first to appreciate different racial and cultural groups and beginning to eliminate some of the discrepancies between them. And indeed, we've made sufficient progress so that we now, of course, have an African-American president, et cetera, and all that. But as all that was happening, we were, in fact, from a different standpoint, that is, an economic standpoint, becoming a progressively unequal society. And one of the things that becomes clear the minute you begin to talk about this, especially if you talk about it in public, is that people are very, very attached to our success in anti-racism, and they're actually equally attached to our failure, that is, the idea that we have much, much more to do. And they're not all that interested in the economic inequality question. So that, in effect, you could see that one of the things that the London Review of Books piece that just came out a couple of weeks ago, my original title for it was Neoliberalism's Good Conscience. For whatever reason, they didn't use that, but my idea about that is just that anti-racism, promotion of diversity, anti-sexism, anti-homophobia, all of which are intrinsically good things, and none of which I criticize, you know, as such, but all of them now have served to provide a good conscience for left neoliberals who worried intensively about those sets of issues and have not worried at all, except a kind of lip service, even then, until recently, remarkably little lip service about the increasing class inequality. So, yeah, you've got a whole bunch of people who think of themselves as attractively and plausibly and firmly on the left, and what they mean by that is they take very strong positions against racism, against sexism, against homophobia, indeed, very strong positions against discrimination of all kinds, but they sort of tell the people who worry about exploitation, which is a very different thing from discrimination, we'll talk about that later. And, in fact, we haven't talked about it at all.
Well, yeah, I think a lot of your critics, certainly the internet left, has been buzzing with criticisms of your recent writings, and they seem to think that you don't think that that the struggle against racism and homophobia and sexism are valuable in themselves. Are these important victories?
Partial, absolutely, but certainly. Yeah, I mean, the argument in the interview of books piece was not that they are important, nor that they are good, it's that they don't today consist in a contribution to a left politics. You know, when people, gay people should be entitled to marry each other, in my view. Right-wing gay people should be entitled to marry each other, and left-wing gay people should be entitled to marry each other. And in fact, I think that's increasingly a position that will become more and more accepted on the right and on the left. It's not an accident that the federal suit filed in California is filed by, you know, Boies and Ted Olson, one on sort of the liberal side and one on the Republican side. It's also, of course, completely true. There's lots of right-wing and lots of religious opposition to gay marriage. But in general, I think it's a crucial thing to acknowledge, to say that on the one hand, it's really a good thing that anti-discrimination of all kinds is being attacked in neoliberal society. But on the other hand, it's also an important thing to say that anti-discrimination is completely compatible with neoliberalism. After all, efficient markets are more efficient when you're not eliminating sort of labor forces with respect to their race and their gender or their sexual proclivities. So there's an important sense in which the neoliberal agenda is simultaneously an anti-discrimination agenda and an exploitation agenda. And those two things do not contradict each other. And I think it is true. It's not just, you know, the left-wing blogs. I mean, in general, the arguments that I've made, and I'm not alone in this, I mean, you've often had Adolf Reed on, and Adolf makes some of these same kinds of arguments, are met with a great deal of sometimes distrust and sometimes anger. But I think that part of that is because the commitment to a model of social justice in which racial and sexual disparity is the core is very, very intense in American life. I mean, just the other day I got sent a thing by a colleague which said, it's a meeting taking place among some very, you know, strongly liberal, if not left, people in Chicago, and they're worried about the overrepresentation of minority children in child welfare programs, and they want to address that problem. But the minute you pose the problem that way, you're already, as it were, within the sort of framework of neoliberalism. Because the problem surely is not that minority children are overrepresented in child welfare. If that were really the problem, the overrepresentation, you could solve it really easily by just like having more poor white kids. But no one thinks or should think from the left that having more poor white kids would help solve the problem. The problem is not that there are more poor black kids than there are poor white kids proportionally. The problem is the poverty in itself. And the question of the skin color is actually completely secondary to that issue. So we have this entire society that's built, in effect, on representing ourselves to ourselves in racial and sexual terms, and therefore in representing our problems as if they were fundamentally problems about disparities between the races or the sexes. But the minute we start doing that, we, in effect, posit a goal, the goal of proper representation, which would make no difference whatsoever, you know, to economic equality.
The way I think of this myself lately is that race is kind of an amplifier of tendencies in American society. It's a very violent and unequal place, and race just amplifies the inequality and the violence. Is that at all compatible
with
your view
of things? Well, I think, I'm not quite sure. I know it amplifies things. I'm not quite sure what you mean by it. But I do think there is a way in which, I mean, at certain moments, because of the obvious and brutal injustices of racism, anti-racism has been a powerful force for correcting inequalities of all kinds. And I think no one, you know, would argue against that. But it's also tremendously obscures problems. I mean, today, actually, people literally get angry at me when I just remind and accuse me of sort of worrying exclusively about white people when I just point out, as anybody can tell just by going to the U.S. Census on the web, that the vast majority of people, the largest group of poor people in this country today are white people. If you look at the bottom quintile of American income, 60% of those people are white. Now, white people are underrepresented because if you look at the whole population, about 70% are white. So absolutely, they're underrepresented at the bottom, overrepresented at the top. Black people, it's vice versa. They're overrepresented at the bottom, underrepresented at the top. But when you think about that, you realize we would not be better off if white people were 70% of the poor and black people were only 13.2%. Nor would we be better off if white people were 70% of the super rich and black people were 13.2%. And part of the problem we have is that we have come ourselves to think of this very fundamental issue of economic inequality as if it were itself a racial issue. As if we just could really end racism and really end sexism, then in fact we would have solved that problem. But in fact we wouldn't have made the slightest progress towards solving it. And indeed we're not even making any effort to solve it insofar as we're committed to a simply racist, anti-racist, or simply anti-sexist agenda. So there's an important sense in which I think, yeah, you're right, it amplifies, but I think there's another important sense in which it completely mystifies. As well, I remember one reviewer, the first thing I did in this, the book called The Trouble with Diversity, an African-American woman writing in Chicago, saying, hey, look, the great discovery of this book is that the majority of poor people are white. And the idea that that would count as a discovery for anybody is truly amazing. You know, it's like perfectly obvious that the majority of poor people are white. And it's not a service to poor black people to sort of convince the world that basically there are only poor black people. So I think really we've reached a point now where the sort of racialization of every statistic in American life, and above all the racialization, you can see it in the healthcare debate. I mean, you got people who, in fact, are no doubt racist, opposed to the healthcare program precisely because they think it disproportionately benefits white black people. That's not true, though. It would benefit a whole lot more white people than would black people. So on both sides, there's a lot of confusion, and a lot of that confusion stems from the fact that we are much more comfortable and are now much more committed to thinking in racial terms than we are to thinking in class terms.
Speak with Walter Ben Michaels, who's a professor of literature at the University of Illinois Chicago and author of many pieces and books on diversity and the problems with it. One of your critics, Richard Seymour, who blogs under the name Lenin's Tomb, points to the work of David Roediger and claims that you don't understand the sense in which Roediger's historical work shows that capitalism requires some kind of racial sorting mechanism to divide the working class. How do you plead to that charge?
Well, discussion of David Roediger's work would take a long time, and while there may be some things about it I don't understand, there are many more things that I think I understand pretty well but don't agree with. But I would say the one thing that would be relevant here is that there actually is not a lot of controversy about the important role that racism has played in American capitalism. We all agree that throughout the 19th century, certainly, and for much of the 20th century, racism was crucial, whether it was indeed one of the roles it played was just that of dividing the working class, but that was by no means the only role it played, producing a certain kind of labor force that is beginning with slaves and then beginning and then culminating with Jim Crow labor was absolutely fundamental for the kinds of capitalist organizations and structures that were developed in the U.S. in first in the colonial period and then throughout the 19th century. But it doesn't follow from that that this is, as it were, a logical relation between capitalism and racism. And one of the real problems with a lot of the work that's done today is it really very much takes the 18th and 19th century as if historical precedent counted somehow as kind of ongoing, and that is as if the things that were happening in the 19th and early 20th century are still happening now, and indeed as if capitalism were still working the same way. So at this point, I think it's ludicrous to think that actually the primary point of racism is to divide the white and black working class. Indeed, the very concept of white and black working class is kind of problematic right now. Right now, in fact, anti-racism is much more useful to capitalism than racism is. It's no accident that every single major corporation in this country has a vast human relations department, a great portion of which is devoted to protecting, defending, and promoting diversity. And in fact, this is not just a U.S. thing. You know, you can almost make it a kind of sociological law. I've been working also on France and the United Kingdom in the last two or three years, that as a society becomes, in today's world, as Western neoliberal societies become more unequal, they also become more committed to diversity. So that the rise of the discourse of diversity in France over the last 5 years is extraordinary. The rise of the same thing in the UK over the last 10 to 15 years is extraordinary, and it's in every case accompanied by larger and larger, in the case of the UK and the United States, vast discrepancies in wealth, vast inequalities. France, not quite so bad yet. So I just think that's completely, you know, it's completely backwards. And in fact, what it does is reify a certain notion of what capitalism is, reify a certain notion of what racism must do, and then put them together forever. And people are extremely attached to that in the U.S., less attached to it in France, but attached to the U.S.
You could argue that capitalism's ideal is each of us is an individual atom in competition with each other, and that racial and sexual attributes are obstacles to that kind of perfect competition.
Well, yeah. I mean, and that's certainly true. I don't think we're quite there yet. In a kind of very perfect capitalist world, then there would indeed be no racism and no sexism, because what you want is the people who could do the best job for the least money. And, of course, that has nothing whatsoever to do with their race and their sex. That would be the point of anti-racism and anti-sexism. I don't think we're there yet. I mean, I don't think it's the case that race doesn't still have a role to play in American political life, and that racism doesn't have a role to play in American political life. But I do very much think that the extraordinary self-righteousness of, you know, one of the things that race does for people on the left is it turns politics into a kind of ethics for them. so that they have a tremendous commitment to thinking of themselves as ethically superior to their opponents, because their opponents are not simply people who support a very different political construction, a very different political system. They're not people who are simply committed to the free market. They're people who are also racists. So we spend an incredible amount of time on the left trying to make sure that our enemies are not just people who have strong ideological differences with us, but are also bad people. And I actually think that's not only a complete waste of time and intellectual energy, but it's also deeply misleading. You know, it helps us misrecognize them. The problem about George Bush during all those years of Bush's making things worse and worse was not that George Bush was an evil racist. And the amount of time spent trying to convince people, spent trying to convince themselves and committing themselves to the idea that Bush was an evil racist, was time that was completely wasted.
Now, this kind of understanding of race that you're talking about tends to make it a problem of subjectivity or as a psychological issue rather than looking at social structures.
Well, it does. I mean, that's certainly true, and there is a great deal of that. All the sensitivity training that goes on about that and says that we're all a little bit racist, and you want to say, in that sense, it's kind of almost completely irrelevant. But I think it's also deeper in a certain way, because when we think about discrimination, part of what discrimination involves is, of course, discriminatory intent, and that is, in some sense, psychological. But we also talk about discriminatory effects, and discriminatory effects may not be psychological. They may be things, I mean, after all, there are lots of things in the U.S. today that are, in which blacks are disproportionately disadvantaged, not necessarily because of present prejudice, but because of the legacy of past prejudice. But the core thing is, as long as we define the problem above all and exclusively in terms of discrimination, we describe the problem in an extremely misleading way, because as you were suggesting before, capitalism at this moment is not that interested in discrimination. Capitalism is actually interested in producing a workforce where discrimination is eliminated and where the competition among laborers for the sort of what there is left can proceed freely without that kind of discrimination. So there's a certain sense in which even once you set this aside, it's true that the sort of ethical people are very committed to the psychological and very committed to being able to lambaste their opponents as being, in some sense, not just mistaken but evil. But it's also true that even with the best intentions of the world, and even giving up that ethics and that morality, as long as the center of your social justice program is anti-discrimination, as long as anti-discrimination isn't not only supplemented by, but in this case, you know, very significantly supplemented by anti-exploitation, you're not going to have an anti-capitalist social left. What you're going to have is like the left wing of capitalism. And even the most hysterical bloggers actually just belong to the left wing of capitalism.
Well, we've only got a minute or so left, but you pointed to some kind of mechanism by which the more neoliberal a society becomes, the more focused it becomes on these kinds of diversity issues. What's the cause and effect there?
Well, I think one crucial one, the cause part, is just that is the crucial element of neoliberalism is mobility of workforces. In the U.S., I started out by working on racism, and the first thing I was paying attention to was the 1924 Immigration Act, the Johnston Immigration Act, also called the National Origins Act, and the whole point of that act was to keep people who didn't count as white out, from black people to yellow people to Jews to you name it. That we all know that act was completely scrapped in 1965 by the Immigration Act. That, the 1965 Immigration Act was, in one sense, one of the first major neoliberal achievements in the U.S. What was the good part about it? The good part about it was it basically got rid of racial quotas. Not totally, but largely eliminated race as an element in immigration. What was the reason for it? The reason for it is actually proclaimed in the act itself. The primary criterion should be one or two various different kinds of things, but the primary one should be people who are able to benefit the economy of the United States. Well, if you're going to benefit the economy of the United States, people will start bringing you in. And that the benefit of the economy means we have a massive increase in Asian immigration. We have, despite our well-known nativism and our very real nativism, a massive tolerance for illegal Mexican immigration. Why? Because all of these make a kind of contribution in different ways at different class levels to the economy of the United States. When you've got that, sort of neoliberal immigration, not only migration of capital across borders, but of labor across borders, then obviously you have a racism problem, which is to say you now have to manage these quite different populations, all of whom are going to make up your workforce and going in many ways to make your workforce a lot cheaper. Believe me, you know, a lot of Chicago could not run without basically illegal immigrant labor. So you then got as a neoliberal management project, how to get these people to get along with each other, how to get them to work with each other. In a certain sense, like the whole diversity program has been nothing but an attempt to learn how to manage our increasingly multiracial population. And we have to learn how to do that if we're good neoliberals, because you can't get the work out of this population without being able to manage it. So there's an important sense in which the very problem of racism as it's been reconfigured in the sort of last 30 years is a problem produced by neoliberalism, and anti-racism is the solution to that problem.
All right, thank you. I have to get out of here a little early today, so I have to cut it short here. Thanks for joining us, Walter Ben Michaels. I've been speaking with Walter Ben Michaels, professor of literature at the University of Illinois, Chicago, and author of several works on diversity and the problems with it. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Till next week. Bye.